the enemy attacked their city. Rome put an end to all that, and so they were marvelous leaders from a secular standpoint. They knew how to handle men, they knew how to build, they knew how to overcome problems with solutions. So in many ways, they had benefited the world. You could see why a city like Smyrna would be dedicated and respectful of Rome. And then as the epitome of Rome, the Caesar was one who was looked upon as being wise and a benefactor to mankind, especially if he were in his good favor. And so it was a small step between calling him Lord with a little L to Lord with a capital L. And that's what happened. Some of the Caesars took it more seriously than others, but emperor worship became popular during the time, the end of the first century and on into the next two centuries. And the Christians paid a price for that because they would not, could not go along with emperor worship. And Smyrna was a place that really enjoyed emperor worship and wanted to please the emperor. What they did was they would build an altar and a statue of the Roman Caesar. And then when you came into the city, you would burn incense there on the altar, pay your respects to the Caesar. And then you would be given a libellus or a license. We don't think much about it, but if you don't have proper credentials, even in our society, you have difficulty doing a lot of things. If you don't have a valid driver's license, for instance, if you don't have a social security number, or if you are not a native or not from America, and then you need a green card or a visa that's up to date, if you don't have those papers, then your doors are going to close to you even in a modern free land. Can you imagine what it was like in those days? Without the libellus, you were not allowed to do business, for instance. You could not open a business. You could not work for many of the larger enterprises in the city. And you couldn't even buy and sell. Now, you could on the black market, you could behind the scenes, but you were going to be limited in what you were able to do in that society. So the Christians had difficulty even accomplishing relatively simple things like getting food and purchasing necessary items and building and getting a good job that would support their families. Well, with that background in mind, let's just go through some of these pictures. I'd like to sort of give you a feel for the ancient city. If you will, click on the one that's called View. I think it'll be a little larger. It's a blue and yellow icon. Do you see it? We can look at this one, but I didn't sanitize this one. There were a couple of statues that I don't want to show in public in one of these files, so. That's all right. I know where they are. We'll go with this. This is good. All right. Here's the Temple of Athena. Now, these are just some ruins. You can't tell a lot with some of these, but this is the Temple of Athena. I mentioned it was a pagan city. That's what's left of it. You see some of the pillars in the background. This is not a lampstand, I guess you can guess, but that's the aqueduct where they would cistern, where they would collect the water. And then it was pretty elaborate. You see, it was underground, but it would supply the water for the city. This is the first story of one of the agoras, they're called. We would call it a park, a place where they would do business, or they would also have space to have open-air speeches or just kids play, those kind of things. Here's the city of Izmir, Turkey, today. I hope you can see right in the center of that. Right in the center of that, you see the large building, and then toward under it is the ancient city, and the ruins that we've been looking at have been built all the way around with the modern city, which is sort of interesting. If you've ever been to San Antonio and been to the Alamo, it's the same kind of situation where you have this 400-year-old fort and then large buildings, banks all around it. Well, that's what you have here. That's a picture of a lion that was in one of those agoras. It's sort of broken, but you can see the artistry that they were capable of. You see that large building in the background? That's the same building we saw in that earlier picture, and those are the ruins in the foreground. Another picture of it. This is from a little bit later, but that's a Muslim tomb. You see the Muslim imagery. there. So the city has undergone a lot of different religions through the years. That's the modern city. If you look to the left of center, what we were looking at is it's about in the middle of the map, that large building. Not the largest, but the second largest. We're going to talk about the Jewish presence in the city of Smyrna in a moment, and even today there's still a large Jewish presence in the city. Those are two different synagogue pictures. All right. There are a couple of museums that have some interesting pieces that Luke was able to get us slides of, and I'll show you those quickly. If we need to, we can come back to it a little bit. All right. All right, we talked about lampstands. I don't know if you can go back. Can you go back one? Oh, that's on the viewer. Okay. This is some of the museum pieces. You see the Jewish and the Muslim. You see the mixture in the tombstones. What's interesting here is that they had a statue of a man. You could interchange the head. You could put a different head on the same statue. That's a sundial. You tell time. There's the reef. We're going to talk about the crown of life in a moment. And there are the lampstands that are from that period pieces from that time. All right, switch to the other one. That's just a sarcophagus. I think that was Abraham offering Isaac. Here's some of the coins from the period. Now, the next one, I think, that's Domitian, who is probably emperor during this time. One of these is Trajan. There's several different coins from that period and later times. That's Vespasian, who burned Jerusalem and the temple. That's Athena, one of the goddesses. It's a necklace from that time period made of gold. There's the reef. I wanted you to see that. We're going to talk about a crown of gold. That's what the word means. That's as far as we need to go, Greta. I appreciate it. Thank you. All right, let's pick up then in our discussion of the scriptures in verse 9. I know thy works. That's the first thing he notices about every congregation in this list of seven. He's interested in what they're doing, how they're evangelizing, what their love is prompting them to do in their among themselves and in their community. And even amidst the persecution that they were already facing, you observe that they hadn't stopped working. They had not allowed the devil to intimidate them into just huddling in a corner and not doing anything. He said, I know your works. So they were still working. And tribulation. They had trouble there. Trouble from the outside. The word tribulation here means to be crushed, literally. One way that the Romans would execute someone would be to lay him on the ground or on a slab of concrete or rock, and then place a heavy rock on his chest very gently, easily, and then gradually allow that rock to crush the breath from him and kill him. It was a cruel way to die. That's what the word here means. It means to be slowly crushed to death. So one of the tactics of the devil is to intimidate and try to crush us with opposition, and in this case, it's called tribulation. See if we had a scripture I wanted to add in there for your notes. I can't remember if I mentioned this last week, so I'm going to mention it again and maybe just review if I did. Speaking of how the church got in Smyrna, it's not like Ephesus where you have a whole book, another book of the Bible written to the same church. It's not mentioned in the book of Acts, and so we don't know how it got started. The closest we can find is Acts chapter 19, verse 10, when it says that Paul stayed in Ephesus, just 35 miles away, remember, for 2 years teaching or debating in the school of Tyrannus. And it said that during that time, all of Asia heard the word of the Lord. So that would include this city of Smyrna. So it's possible that while Paul was preaching in that school, he also was taking the weekends, let's say, and going to other cities and evangelizing. Or maybe he would take a month in the summer and go on a preaching trip in that same area and help other cities to learn what Ephesus had been learning. Or it could be, like many schools today, that he sent out his students on the weekends or during the breaks, and they would take the gospel to other areas. Most every preacher school that I'm aware of, during the breaks, you will go on a campaign somewhere and knock doors. Some schools will send you even overseas, and or some schools are placed in Africa or South America, and those students will go out on their breaks and will evangelize. That could be the same situation. We just don't know how the church came to be here, but it's most likely it began about the same time as the church in Ephesus, maybe a little later when Paul was preaching there for those 2 years. All right, let's talk about verse 9. There are no criticisms of this church, unlike the five of the others. The only other church that doesn't have any corrections from Jesus is Philadelphia and Smyrna, those two. They have words of praise. That's what we're reading in verse 9. We're going to see in a moment words of prophecy in verse 10. He tells them what their future holds, and it's not altogether a bright future, at least in the temporary. And then he gives them words of promise that he's going to fulfill his promises. That would be very comforting to them. So let's watch for words of praise, words of prophecy, and words of promise as we go through this section. You might put in your notes beside tribulation or beside the verse there, James 2, 1 through 4. I know our young people are studying James and 1st, 2nd Peter now for their Bible Bowl and Lance to Leaders. So we've been reading through James again and studying it some. That first section is really beneficial. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers temptations, knowing this, the trying of your faith worketh patience, but let patience have a perfect work that may be perfect and entire, wanting or lacking nothing. Think about those three verses, James 1, 2 through 4. Count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. King James says, New King James says, various trials, I believe. That's what it means. It's not talking about temptation to do evil. He talks about that later in the same chapter, verses 13 through 15. But there he's talking about count it joy when you have challenges to your faith. Well, why is that? Because it produces a worthy product in your life. It produces patience. And who among us does not need more patience? So one way to get that is the trying of our faith. And notice also that text says that God will bless us. We can ask Him, and He will not upbraid us for asking Him, and He will bless us with more wisdom. So that text is parallel with that idea from Revelation 2:9. Let's move to the next section of the same verse. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. Now, on the surface, you might say, well, there's a contradiction here. He says they're poor, but he also says they're rich. Obviously, words can be used in more than one way. So they were poor in one sense, but they were rich in another sense. Well, in what sense? Well, they were poverty-stricken physically. Possibly this had to do with the persecution they had already faced, because one of the things that the government would do to those that were they wanted to persecute was to confiscate their goods. Then if that didn't work, they might exile them to another place, like John was in exile here, or imprison them, or even eventually kill them. There's evidence even here in Revelation 2 of one martyr already by this time. But it's possible these Christians that had their goods, their homes invaded by government officials, and their goods confiscated, making them even more poverty-stricken than they were before. Now remember, the Scripture says that not many mighty, not many noble are called, 1 Corinthians 1:26. So the church started out below average in all likelihood in this city as far as wealth was concerned. In Mark 13, I think it might be verse 37, but I'm not sure. Someone could look that up for us. It says, and the common people heard him gladly. So common people were attracted to Jesus in the first century, and it has been traditionally that way through the ages. So this church was a poor church physically, did not have a lot of wealth. But in another sense, they were rich. They were rich in faith. They were rich in heaven. Do you remember what Jesus taught in Matthew 6, 20, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, where thieves cannot break through and steal. So we could put our treasures in a place that has the best interest, better interest than any bank on earth. We could have our treasures in heaven. The same idea is found in Ephesians 3:8, where Paul said, "Unto me who am less than least of all saints, is this grace given, that I should preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ." Paul was in the business of making men rich, not physically, but spiritually. What price could you put on the ability to pillow your head at night and know that all your sins are washed away, and if you never wake up, you'll be in a better place? What price could you put on getting out of that same bed the next morning with a purpose and a reason to live? What price could you put on being on a deathbed and saying, "I have no fear, I'm going to meet my Lord"? What price could you put on being able to get down on your knees beside that same bed and saying, "Dear God in heaven, I have a problem. Would you help me with my problem?" What price could you possibly put on? Well, you could just go on and on and on with the blessings of Christianity. They were rich, as we are rich, but they might not have had two nickels to rub together, but they had so many blessings they couldn't count them all. So they were poor and they were rich. And there's an interesting contrast between the church at Smyrna and the church at Laodicea. They're complete opposites. This church is poor in physical things, but rich in blessings. The church at Laodicea, that we'll see in chapter 3, were rich in physical things, but they were poverty-stricken in spiritual things. So of the two, obviously, it would be better to be like Smyrna and to be temporarily without and to have the blessings in eternity than to have that reversed. "I know thy works of tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich." Now we continue verse 9. "And I know the blasphemy." That indicates that they were being ridiculed. They were being spoken against. Turn over with me to Matthew chapter 5. You remember how the Beatitudes go. "Blessed are the poor in spirit," 5:3, all the way down to verse 10. The eighth of the Beatitudes, the last of them. "Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake." Now what's this? What kind of persecution could followers of Jesus expect to endure? Well, he lists three different kinds here. "Blessed are ye, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven," verse 11 now. "Blessed are ye when men shall," what? "Revile you," speak against you. And what's the second one? "Persecute you," that's physical persecution. It would be different kinds, but that would certainly be included in it. And then the third one, "and say all manner," what? "Against you falsely for my sake." So two of the three there are verbal persecutions. The other one, a more broad term that would include all different kinds of persecution. Verse 12, "Rejoice and be exceeding glad when I'm persecuted, when I'm spoken against, when I'm blasphemed," to use the word of Revelation 2:9. Well, why? "For great is your reward in heaven." God does not allow that to go unnoticed. He accredits our account, if we might use it that way, in heaven, "for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." It put you in good company. So these brothers and sisters in Smyrna understood what persecution was about. They knew about tribulation. They knew about being spoken against. But Jesus was not telling them, I know what you're going through. You're not alone, and you will be blessed for it. I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. We mentioned in the slideshow that there was a Jewish presence in Smyrna, even in this generation. And evidently, this city had a large Jewish population, probably because it was a commercial center and they had many businesses that they would come and bring to that place. And then, wherever the Jews were, if the Christians were there, they persecuted them. Turn with me over to the book of Acts. I'll just read four or five scriptures with you. I have read these many times, but I hadn't really noticed in concert with the others how often the scriptures mentions the persecution of the Jews, unreasonable persecution of the Jews against Christians. Let's start in Acts 13, verse 50. We won't spend much time in any one of these, but I just want you to see them one after the other. Obviously, you're going from city to city and from one year to another year, but the same thing is happening again and again. Someone who would be comfortable reading for us Acts 13, verse 50, please. Who stirred up the women and the Jews and caused the Christians to be persecuted? Look now at chapter 14, verse 2. Someone else, please. 14:2.
The unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and made their minds evil against the brethren.
So the Jews stirred up people against the brethren, the Christians. Same chapter, verse 5. Someone else, please. Jews involved in that persecution, even to the point of stoning, killing someone. Verse 19, same chapter.
And Jews from Antioch and Iconium came there, and having persuaded the multitudes, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead.
So they're in foreign cities. They're following Paul around, stirring up trouble for Paul, and has him stoned. These weren't even the natives of the cities he was going to. Look at chapter 17, verse 5. Someone else, please.
But the Jews, which believed not, moved them and took them to them certain heavy followers of the race and sword, and gathered a company and set all the city on an uproar and saw them behind.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And sought to bring them out to the people.
So the Jews, moved with any envy, got others and caused the house of Jason and other Christians to be persecuted. One other verse, chapter 24, verse 2. Yes, 24:2. All the way through the book of Acts, you see this common link from Jerusalem, where they persecuted Jesus and killed him, and then his followers, even from city to city. 24:2. All right, now that's a part of a larger context where Tertullus has been hired by the Jews to persecute or to bring accusation against Paul, and he does so and contributes to Paul having to be in prison at the end of the book. So you see this from chapter to chapter, city to city, place to place, situation to situation. The Jews are constantly putting barriers in front of God's church as it tries to carry the gospel to the world. Now let's go to Romans chapter 2 while we're there close in Acts. And see that God had a change in His chosen people. Sometimes you'll hear people today saying the Jews are the chosen people. Some of our American policy toward Israel is based on that erroneous view. The Jews have not been God's chosen people for 2,000 years. Once they nailed Jesus to the cross, you remember when Jesus in Matthew 24 said, "Your house is left to you desolate," at the end of that chapter? Well, that was their house. God had already forsaken it. They killed Jesus, and then the Roman army was allowed to come in and destroy it. Their religion, for practical purposes, ended them because they couldn't even keep up with the records of what tribe they were from and who were true priests and who were not true priests. And so the Israel of God changed from the physical descendants of Abraham, from Genesis 12, 1 through 3, to the spiritual descendants of Abraham, those who had the faith of Abraham. That's a theme that runs through a lot of chapters in the New Testament. Romans is one good place to see it. Look at the last two verses. These are verses that you'll want to remember because as you study with people, this will come up and they will talk about the Jews are God's chosen people. They won't understand the Old Testament has been done away and replaced with the New Testament. And so these are good verses to know. Romans 2, 28 and 29. For he is not a Jew, which is one, what? Outwardly. In other words, it doesn't have to do with circumcision. It doesn't have to do with if you can take your pedigree all the way back to Abraham, 2000 B.C. You can show what tribe you're from, what family. It doesn't have anything to do with the physical anymore. The change has taken place. Of course, the reason that that was important in the Old Testament was because a promise had been made to Abraham that through his physical line, who would be born? Christ. And once Jesus was born to Mary, then that was no longer, it was no longer key that the physical line be kept. And so it switched to the physical, to the spiritual line. He is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one, which is one what? Inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, the cutting away of sin from the heart, from the inner man, throwing it away in the spirit and not in the letter, whose praise is not of man but of God. So you see that Judaism was replaced with Christianity. God's chosen people had been Jewish in the Old Testament, but now are from all nations, and they have this in common, that they are believers in Jesus. They are followers of the New Testament order.
This is probably a stupid question. Does that mean like now if a Jew becomes a... gets saved, or is he still, he's just a Christian, right?
Yeah, it's just like an American Christian or an African Christian, a Jewish Christian, you know. The thing that's important there is not his background, but his faith. So that's a good question. And you might also put in your notes there Galatians 6:16, which mentions the Israel of God, referring to the church, which shows Israel today is not a physical location or a physical people, but it is a spiritual entity, the church. Now let's go back over to Revelation chapter 2, verse 9. We'll pick up with the last part of verse 9. Let's discuss it just a little bit more. The blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Some commentators believe that it's possible that the Christians were actually worshiping in the synagogue at different times. Remember, Jews worshiped on Saturday, Christians worshiped on Sunday. And there's some evidence, of course, as you go through the book of Acts, that Christians interacted in synagogues. Could be that they were worshiping in the synagogue, according to the New Testament teachings, of course, but that brought them in contact with the Jews and thus led to persecution. It's possible. We know that there were no church buildings that we have on record for at least 100 years after this, probably closer to 200. So they were worshiping in whatever places they could find, sometimes outdoors, sometimes public buildings, sometimes people's houses. So that could be one reason he mentions the synagogue here. But notice it's not the synagogue of God anymore, because they're not serving God's purpose when they're persecuting God's children. He calls them the synagogue of Satan. They're working for the other side now, because they are making it difficult for the Christians to be faithful to their commitment to Jesus. A question that I had and I did a little research on is, how is it that the Jews who were in the Roman Empire, who were monotheistic, and according to their religion, even though it was outdated, they were still going by it, they could not worship the emperor either. So how is it that the Jews got away with not worshiping the emperor, and the Christians got arrested or imprisoned or exiled or goods confiscated? Well, there seem to be two answers to that. One, and possibly both of them are true, and remember, you're talking about an empire-wide persecution, at least at times, and you're also talking about a lot of different individuals, so what's true in one case might not be true in another. But one of them is that they were willing to compromise, sort of cross their fingers and do what was required of them, say, I don't really mean it. It's possible that they would burn an incense and then go about their business. They weren't that convicted. Whereas the Christians, of course, some Christians gave up their faith under persecution also. But the true Christians endured it, whatever it took in order to remain faithful. The second idea, and probably this is also true, is that the Jews were a legalized religion in the Roman Empire, and that they were able to substitute praying for the emperor instead of burning incense to the emperor. And thus, the Romans tolerated the Jewish religion, legalized it, allowed them not to have to burn the incense and to commit what they would consider sacrilege, but they would not make that exception for the Christians, a newer religion and also not a popular one, as we noticed in our introduction to this class. Anybody have a question or a thought up through verse 9? Yeah, there's a parallel there. And what passage was that again? Somebody may want to write it in their notes. Colossians 2, 11 through 14. Was it 14? Okay. So you might want to write that in your notes also. That is a good parallel verse. And also, you could put down Romans 6, 1 through 6, which is also similar to that, buried with Christ, and that form of doctrine that's mentioned in verses 14 and 15 would also tie in with that. Very good. Someone else may have something. Yes. That's a good thought. I had not considered that. If you couldn't hear what Gene was saying, he said it may have to do with the Christians following the king of the Jews being a rival to the Caesar. You see that early on, of course, with the killing of the infants when Jesus was born. So that's a good thought. Anybody else? I guess we'll stop there. It looks like we're...